Time to meet another New Zealand native species with our Critter of the Week expert, Nicola Tookie from the Department of Conservation. Hello.
Hello. I thought you were describing me for a second there. But
oh, yeah. You are a native species.
I am.
I don't know if you're endangered, but you are rare, definitely, and unique.
Thanks, Jessie. How's your week gone?
Oh, pretty good. I talked to someone this week and it made me think of you. I should make sure I get her name right and I'll look it up now to make sure that is the case. But we were talking about a forest on the East Coast where they're trying to get some funding for predator control. And you and I don't often talk about 1080 because we both find it quite triggering. However, this is quite interesting because she, you know, for people who are just casual listeners, almost everyone in the conservation or science environment, people who know what they're talking about, are in favour of 1080 in New Zealand, the only way of sort of controlling wide-scale pests until there's a better solution. And I talked to a woman called Ora, who is trying to get some 1080 happening on their particular rohe, on their forest, and I said, how did you get your whānau across the line with 1080, because there's a lot of like myths and scare tactics out there. Like if you looked on Facebook, it would be, you know, pretty hard. It would worry you. And she said, and this is quite a simple strategy, Nick, but it was so cool. She said, we actually went to some other forests where they'd used 1080 to see what it was like. And she said, it was so astounding, the amount of bird life and bird song and the health of the forest that, you know, the science reports and the inquiries and everything are one thing, but actually it was really hard to argue with just, you know, looking around these forests, actually being in them and seeing what was going on. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly who you're talking about, Ora Barlow. She's amazing.
Yeah, Ora Barlow, Tukaki.
That's correct. I know that they're particularly talking about the Raukumara range, aren't they? Near Gisborne. And I mean, I saw a TV program on this maybe last year, and it was about some of the leaders in Kaumatua over there actually going and spending some, you know, a few nights camping in the Raukumaras, and, you know, the heartache they felt at the loss of the life in their forest and the loss of Māori, you know, that kind of, that sense of life in the hearing the birds and seeing everything growing. So I think there's nothing more compelling than a go and see. And I think they went to places like Puriora and other places like that, which are just overwhelmingly benefiting from landscape scale pest control and have for decades and decades and decades. So, you know, that's great to hear. And, you know, I think it does get a bit exhausting having the 1080 conversation with the inevitable response from a small group of people who like to make a lot of noise. But certainly in terms of the health of our wildlife overall, the proof is in the pudding, as it were. So, yeah, I think you're right.
It's one thing to be given. More effective than telling people they're stupid or that they haven't read widely enough or that they're anti-science or whatever is just, you know, go check it out.
Yeah, that's right. And look, you know, my grandfather is, I think, maybe 87 now, and up until very recently has been a possum contractor and trapper for many, many years, and he's a very keen hunter, and he spends so much time in the bush. You know, it's very obvious to him which bits of bush are benefiting, and it's always the ones that have had that treatment. So that's great. I'm glad you've been talking to her, and I'm you know, really keen to hear how they get on with the Raukumaras, because there's so much opportunity.
Yeah, well, they're saying we're shovel-ready, so give us some funds, we'll get into it. You've been marking a bit of an anniversary this week.
Yeah, that's right, and it kind of relates to this, you know. So we have this sort of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as a country coming out of lockdown, and I know everybody's sort of ready to bolt out of the gates at Flemington and get stuck into some very important mahi, and particularly for those businesses that have been suffering, you know, I get that. But, you know, we've all spent time now thinking about what we want to do as a country and who we want to be, and I think it's really important to note that some of those shovel-ready projects might actually be the most beneficial in terms of being shovel ready to turn things around for our nature, and also see the benefit of that, long-term economic benefits, long-term social benefits. And I don't know if you saw it, but our Director General had a bit of an opinion piece on stuff this week, essentially saying that the same thing. You know, we've got a really important choice here, and do we go forward in the same direction as we've been travelling to date, living beyond our environmental means, or do we use this very unique opportunity to sort of shift our focus a little bit and ensure that we're not only looking after our kind of, you know, economic progress as a country, but adding to that, what does it look like to ensure that we have economic progress with environmental outcomes? Because, you know, we're still seeing that suffering. And so a year ago today, or thereabouts, I was returning from that very big week at UNESCO in Paris, where, you know, almost 150 countries sat in a room for hours and hours and hours. I think my shortest day that week was 15 hours, negotiating the global assessment on biodiversity and ecosystem services, which is really just a big way of saying counting all the nature. And what transpired in the media was lots and lots and lots of international and national reports about what they were calling the Million Species Report, and the headlines were all about the fact that the scientists had demonstrated that, you know, a million species were facing extinction. But that was kind of gutting for me, because to me the most important part of that report was the final chapter, which was on transformative change, and it's about exactly what we're talking about now, which is, okay, so how do you design and redesign and repurpose your economic systems, your social systems, your education systems and health to ensure that you're kind of capturing all of those things. So, it's been really odd to A, think I was on the other side of the world and flying internationally this time last year, and B, think about the opportunity we now presented with as a nation and as a world in terms of the choices we make from here on in. So, it's been great to see so much noise about people out and about, you know, as they're walking around their homes and seeing humpback whales in Wellington Harbour and seeing falcons in their backyards. And, you know, maybe this is a chance for us to really put those at the forefront while we're looking after ourselves.
Yep, there'll be plenty of people listening who agree with you. In the meantime, let's meet one of the species that we're interested in saving. And this is a real cracker. I can't believe that we haven't covered this one already, given that it's perfect for Critter of the Week.
This is an amazing species. Today we're going to talk about the New Zealand flatworm. There are more than 100 different species, we think, of terrestrial flatworms. So flatworms can live in the sea and in freshwater as well. And this one is a ripper. A, because it's disgusting. So they kind of look like a very flat sort of leech or slug. And they produce mucus, but they're also voracious predators. And so they are known as a voracious carnivorous flatworm, and they basically use their physical force. So if you think about the way that they're structured, they're just basically all muscle and mucus to chase down worms, earthworms, and capture them, and then they eat them from the outside in. Amazing. Even better than that, the New Zealand flatworm, or Arthodendius triangulatus, it's not that it's better, but, you know, we're always struggling in terms of New Zealand wildlife in terms of the pests that came here, particularly from Europe, you know, and we just got kind of offloaded a whole lot of pests that have just destroyed our nature. A little bit of, it's not so nice to say karma, but these guys are actually...
I know what you mean.
They're a pest
in
Europe.
You don't want to celebrate the fact... You don't want to celebrate the fact that the New Zealand flatworm has travelled to the UK and is eating all the earthworms and causing a real menace. However, there is a slight little bit of national pride when you hear that.
A little bit of, you know, parochial, number one. Sadly for the UK, the New Zealand flatworm got over there and, just annihilated the earthworm fauna. And, you know, that's a real problem in terms of particularly your agricultural production and needing those earthworms to kind of aerate and turn over the soil. So, we're probably not... Probably not the favourite species over there. They'll eventually essentially the worm version of a stoat to their nature. But they are exceptionally cool. I don't know about you. So in terms of where you find them, and I don't know if it is this species. I suspect it might be because they are found in South Island and Stewart Island. I find them under my horse trough. I've got a plastic horse bucket and, you know, water trough. If I lift that up, so they like to be on the top of soil but underneath things, particularly things that are a bit moist. So I quite often find them under there. And when they are disturbed, they roll up into a little ball, a bit like an armadillo. And they are just really, really cool creatures. When I was a kid, this may be a shocker to you, but I was one of those kids who was a wee bit obsessed with anything to do with the nature, and I had this book that was sort of 1950s British book, and I think it referred to sort of overseas flatworms and a particular type called planarians, which I think are freshwater. But you could cut the head and the tail, like make a vertical line through the head or through the tail, and they would grow a new head and a new tail. So some, it's just really cruel, but also really fascinating. Yeah. So some species of flatworm can actually regenerate new body parts. And so, like, if you cut off, if you kind of cut a piece of one off, it'll grow a piece of tail or it'll grow a head, depending on which bits you cut off. Not recommending that anybody go out and do that with New Zealand terrestrial flatworm, because I suspect they are in the group that does not share the regenerative aspects of some of its other broader family.
Yeah. And there is a bit of a lack of knowledge, as with a lot of these tiny critters, about, you know, various aspects of its life. Like, we don't really know much about its predators.
No, and so, you know, I guess that's really important in terms of, you know, all of you up and coming, you know, zoologists out there, instead of picking the cute things like the penguins, why wouldn't you particularly look into the struggles of life for a New Zealand flatworm? Because they're pretty neat. They can be anything from sort
of... To be fair, didn't you pick the penguins?
I did pick the penguins. I knew I was going to trip myself up there. They are really fascinating creatures, easier to access than having to make your way to Antarctica in terms of studying the penguins. I think the more that we can learn about them, the better. I mean, particularly, you know, with regard to climate change and drought, and, you know, it might be really important to understand that if you've got flatworms or you're starting to lose flatworms, that might have wider repercussions for your own kind of well-being and health and ability to, you know, run a farm, for example. I don't know. The point is, someone needs to study them.
Hands up, please. Sciencey people of New Zealand, someone looking to go back and do some postdoctoral work, we need a flatworm expert. There probably are flatworm experts out there, but, you know, the more we know, the better. Could you please rate the physical attractiveness of the flatworm on a scale of 1 to 10, Nicola?
Well, you know, I don't want to do the flatworm a disservice here. We do have one photograph of a flatworm, but which gives you one colour variation. They could be anything from black, brown, quite pale, bright orange, and yeah, they kind of look a bit like a ribbon, also a little bit like a bogey, probably. So I think we probably can't do more than and give it a very well earned 3 in this respect.
Yeah. Yeah, good. I'm with you. Great rating. 3 out of 10 for this very ugly, yet in its own way, charismatic critter. Nicola Tuckey, great to chat to you. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll catch up with you next Friday.
Thanks, Jesse. See ya.
If you'd like to, by the way, have a look at what the flatworm looks like, you can find it on our website, rnz.co.nz/Jesse, and of course that's a great place to look up previous critters as well. 3 years worth, 4 years worth of critters all in one place.